good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Now, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but we ask you to hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Jim Shepherd, who, of course, is we call him the Berkey man. He's the gentleman who actually popularized the Berkey water filters here in the United States, the Big Berkey, and now, of course, something called the Berkey Light. You wonder why even bother to talk about something like that? Well, I will tell you that since the American occupation of Baghdad, and of course, suddenly there's no water over there. Why Jim has been shipping the big Berkey water filters, the Army's been shipping them over to the people in Baghdad, because if something happens to the water, if there's something happens to the whole system, you have to have water to live. And hopefully nothing would ever happen to it here, although there are certainly times when people, for one reason or another, want to get filtered water. A lot of people buy bottled water. They buy lots of bottled water. They just want to have all the impurities out of their water. They're worried about insecticides or pesticides or bacteria, or maybe they don't like the taste of the chlorine, or many, many reasons why people want a water filter. I know we have one. We think it's great. We call it a Berkey Light. But this is an amazing technology. Some of this has been around for 150 years. That's the big Berkey, and then the Berkey Light is really an entirely new approach to water purification. So I'm going to let Jim tell you about this. It's just in certain times, you believe me, ladies and gentlemen, World War III is underway. They haven't told you about it, but we've already fought the first two opening battles. But there are many, many more to come. And my fear is, as so often happens, there is a blowback. And when you begin forcing your ideals on other nations, why, many times there will be retaliation. So, Jim, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about what this is really all about?
Okay. First of all, I'd like to make a small correction. Actually, it's not the Army that is sending the Berkeys to Baghdad. It's the relief organizations. And the relief organizations are very concerned about what's going on in Baghdad, and actually so is our government. They really don't want to see a humanitarian crisis bloom there, and so they're trying to do everything they can to avoid that.
And so these are actually the relief organizations that they're sending over the Berkeys.
That's correct, and putting them into the homes of people. And of course, as you know, and there's a lot of places that don't have electricity, and without the electricity, the water doesn't flow, because typically you have to pump that water up into a water tower. With electricity, you can't do that. So it's created quite a problem for people. And with the Berkey Light and some of our other products, they're able to use the raw, untreated sources of water that are available to them on a local level, you know, like the lakes, the streams.
No, they got the Euphrates River, or the Tigris River. It goes right through there.
That's right. And, of course, if you're going to drink that water, you want to make sure that it's purified and that people don't get sick, because in a crisis, the last thing that people really need to deal with is ill health. And so those filters are being flown over to the people in Baghdad. We initially introduced British Berkfield into the United States, and then we developed the Big Berkey. And those filters were designed to filter raw, untreated sources of water from ponds, lakes, and rivers, and remove the pathogenic bacteria, and then also reduce the chemicals that were in the water. So that during an emergency, if somebody had to rely upon a raw source of water, they'd be able to turn that raw, untreated water into potable water. Since 9/11, we've had a different threat that people have been very concerned about. And right after 9/11, our phones started ringing off, and people were saying, "Geez, you know, what would happen if somebody deliberately tried to, introduce pathogenic bacteria into the water supply?" And this was something that was not being, voiced, in the corners, and in the extreme fringe. This was coming right out of Washington. They were warning people that, there could be attacks on our water supply. So people naturally were very concerned about that. And so we felt that we needed to develop a system that would give people even greater protection than the filters that remove pathogenic bacteria. Now, removal is defined as 99.99% of the pathogens removed. So, for instance, if you have 100,000 pathogens in the test waters, then you would run those test waters through the filter. And if you had 10 or less, that would be a 99% removal rate. And the theory is that your body can, your immune system can handle 10 microbes. It's when you overwhelm your system with thousands of them that you actually get sick. But in the event that there was a deliberate attack on the water supply, we might find more pathogens in the water than you would expect to find in nature. And so we felt that we needed to raise the standard a little bit, raise the hurdle. And so what we did is we tested the new filters, the black Berkey filter elements, with 10,000 times more contamination than you would normally test the filter. And instead of testing at 100,000 microbes per liter, which is typically what you would do, we tested at, we told them to get as many into the water as they could, and they tested it. The terms are lawn growth, or TNTC, too numerous to count, but they know that there's well over a billion organisms per liter. And based on the removal criteria, we would expect that there would be 100,000 microbes or more left in that water, and but the new filters removed everything to non-detectable levels. In fact, they even incubated the water to see if anything would grow in it, and nothing grew. And so we've been told that we've created a whole new standard in water filtration. We're not talking about water filtration anymore. We're talking about water purification. In fact, the conclusion on the report was that there was nothing left in the water but pure H2O.
No, I think that's, of course, then, but some of the minerals will get through, but certainly there's none of the bacteria that get through.
That's right. And when they're testing with, when they're doing the tests, usually they, you know, they start out with pure H2O, and then they put the pathogens in the water, and then they see what you can filter out. And we also did the same thing with chemicals. Typically, when one is testing for chemical reduction, the standard is that you remove 90%. And so most filtration companies will test, and if they start out at 95%, they'll continue to test it until they hit below 90%, and that's where they stop, and that's how they figure the life of the filter. And but what we shot for was non-detectable on the chemicals, and we actually achieved that. And what we did is, instead of going down to the 90% level, we tested until we detected chemicals for the first time. And when we detected, that's where we stopped the filter the test. And based on that, each filter calculates out to last for 2 years. And
so the two filters, why that lasts for 4 years, would that be it?
I'm sorry. Each set of filters lasts for 2 years, and that's presuming that you're using 6 gallons a day.
Oh, okay, both filters together, right.
Yes, and actually most families use more like a gallon and a half to 3 gallons per day. So based on that, they would last for 4 years. And but what we really had in mind was, in the event there was some sort of a artificial crisis, that we would offer a higher level of protection than simply removing the pathogenic bacteria and the chemicals. We wanted to make sure that they were brought down to levels where they could not be detected.
Okay, well, that was really an amazing accomplishment. This is really rather new. These only been out for a short period of time, haven't they?
Yes, we introduced them in March of this year, and it took us a while to prototype them and to test them and to come up with the right formulation. And since we've introduced them, people have been absolutely delighted. The comments that we have gotten back is that they make the water taste sweet. Now, the one difference, the one thing that we have not tried to do is remove minerals from the water, and for health reasons. And so we want to leave the minerals in the water because the minerals, the trace minerals, selenium, magnesium, calcium, and so on and so forth, those are actually helpful and beneficial to your body. But what we did do is we targeted and we put specific media in the filter to target the unwanted minerals such as mercury, aluminum, copper, and we also put designed the filters to reduce nitrates and nitrites, which is something that we were not able to do with the other filters. So what we really wanted to do was clean that water up to a level that really had not been seen before, and that was raw untreated water.
Okay, fine. And of course, now the black mercury will take out MTBE as well, which is a real problem in some states.
That's right. It will reduce it to non-detectable levels.
Mm-hmm. All right, fine. So now, basically, I think for our listeners, there are two filters. One is the big mercury, which has a ceramic filter with an activated carbon core, and those filters can be actually cleaned and used for a much longer period of time.
They have a much longer life, that's correct.
And that's a stainless steel filter. The other is the Berkey Light, which is made of, what is that, a plastic or a material? I know
it's
that
it's actually a polymer.
It's a polymer.
It's Lexan, which is the same material that they use to make bulletproof glass out of. And we use that polymer because it doesn't leach chemicals into the water like other plastics do. And of course what we don't want to do is clean up the water and then have it go into a container that is going to leach chemicals back into the water. And so the new Berkey Light filtration system is designed with clear Lexan plastic. It's blue in color. And the idea behind it is with the stainless steel, many people thought it was inconvenient because when it came time to refill it, they didn't know how much water was in the lower chamber. They didn't want to overfill it. And so with the clear Lexan, that remedies that problem. You can always see the water levels, so you always know how much you can refill the filter system.
Okay, fine. So both of them work. They work very efficiently, but it's simply the Berkey Light is the most modern one, and that works and works very, very efficiently, and certainly the filters are more efficient than the traditional ceramic filters with a activated carbon core.
Yeah, and it really depends on what a person's objective is. Now, if you live in a place where you've got very fairly clean water, and your concern is you want to remove pathogenic bacteria from the water, and your secondary concern is economy, then the ceramic filters are really ideal. If, on the other hand, you really want to purify that water and bring down to non-detectable levels the pathogenic bacteria and the various chemicals that are in the water, the herbicides, pesticides, organic solvents, that type of thing, VOCs, SOCs, and you want to target those unwanted minerals, then really the black Berkey is a very economical filter element, but it will purify the water to a greater degree and offer greater protection.
All right, fine. And of course, you can get the black Berkey filters, for the big Berkey if you want to. And if anybody's interested, they could call our number at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And there is a if you already have a big Berkey and you'd like to replace that with the black Berkey filters, why, there is a Memorial Day special on, but it's just on today, And I mention that because a lot of people listen to these programs are archived, but if you are interested, you can call today and get that. I think it's a very, very good deal. Remember, again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And if you're out there in the listening audience, if you have any questions, this is the man to ask. If you have any questions about water purification or water filtration, there's something that you can take with you that you can move around that will give you a reliable source of water so that whatever happens, at least you'll know if there's a source of water, you're not going to have to boil it or try to distill it. You can filter it and come out with a very potable and very safe product. Now, one of the things, but if you're out there, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. One of the things that I know in many parts of the country, why they are putting fluoride into water. Now, for our listeners who do not know, this is one of the greatest scams of all time. These fluoride products are a byproduct, certainly of the aluminum, the fertilizer manufacturer, would be extremely expensive to put into a toxic dump. So they came up with a great solution. They're going to put it in your drinking water. And you say, oh, well, about the children's teeth. Well, let me tell you that we have many, many references to large studies that have shown that, of course, it doesn't do a bit of good as far as children's teeth. And in areas where they fluoridate and don't fluoridate the water, and there's many of the areas where they fluoridate the water, the children's teeth are actually worse than they are in other areas. And you see this picture of the horrible teeth in children, but it has nothing to do with the fact they don't have fluoride. It has to do with the fact that they're giving these children a sugar solution, and that's why their teeth are getting so pretty in such terrible shape. But the medical complications as far as increased fragility of bones, as far as decreased fertility, attack on the endocrine system, attack on the mind and the brain. In fact, the active ingredient in Prozac is a fluoride compound. Well, anyway, Jim, a lot of people are interested in getting fluoride out of their drinking water, and I think everybody should be concerned about that. And any of your listeners out there who would like more information, they can give us a call, and we'll be glad to send them a little packet on water fluoridation. But what about, of course, getting the fluoride out of the drinking water? How can people do that?
Well, to begin with, fluoride is very easy to put in the water and very difficult to remove from the water. And the reason for that is you'd need to use an incredible amount of media to pull a very small amount of fluoride out. So it makes it rather difficult to remove or extract the fluoride from the water. Now, for people who have the ceramic filters, we've developed the PF4, and those filters are designed, that's a post filter that fits onto the ceramic filters, and it's designed to really target some of the really unwanted chemicals, and like herbicides, pesticides, MTBE, that is in the water that the ceramic does not remove, and it also targets the fluoride, and extracts the fluoride from the water. For those who have the black Berkey filter elements, we don't need to put media in there to remove MTBE because that's already removed. So we have our PF2 filters, and those are designed to extract fluoride and arsenic from the water. Do I hear a break coming up?
You do, and we'll be back here in just a moment or two with our special guest, Jim Shepherd. And when we get back, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you'd like to know a little bit more about the things we're talking about, but I think the one thing that everybody wants to be absolutely certain of, you get by without food, you can't get by without water, and it's just nice to have something no matter where you are, you can take with you, a very effective means of giving you potable water under any circumstances. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest is Jim Shepherd. We call him the Berkey Man. And we're talking about, of course, what you can actually do to get rid of the the fluoride. Now, the Black Mercury filters will take out MTBE, but they won't take out fluoride, at least after a certain number of hours of use.
We made a noble attempt to be able to extract the fluoride from the water with the Black Mercury filter elements. The problem is that we just couldn't make, we have to make the filter so big to make them last for 2 years. That it would be very cumbersome. They'd be huge. And but we did make the noble attempt, and at first we were pretty excited about the results because we were getting better than 99% reduction with the Black Mercury filter elements. And we tested it at 30 parts per million, which is the EPA MCL, which is maximum contamination level. For municipalities is, as I recall, 4 parts per million. So we tested it at the extreme as we try to test all the various different contaminants. And we got about 28 gallons, which calculates out at 4 parts per million to approximately 200 gallons. And then we got analyte breakthrough. And then we dropped to about an 80% reduction and stayed at that for a period of time, and then which is still respectable. There's not many companies that attempt to remove fluoride from the water, but those that do claim about a 75% reduction, so we're still above that, but then we hit another level of analyte breakthrough and it dropped down to 30%, so really to get a long-term solution, we just had to come up with a post-filter.
Okay, and so you have a post-filter from the Big Berkey, and there are four filters. They actually, they sort of hang down like the teats on a cow, and they hang down into the lower compartment, and that they filter, first of all, through the ceramic filters, and then through the post-filters. Is there a post-filter for the Black Berkey yet?
We're expecting that to arrive in about 2 weeks.
All right, fine. So that will be something for the Black Mercury, specifically for the fluoride, but it's not available quite yet. But it will be down the line.
Yes, that's it.
So, of course, this is something I think that people are justifiably concerned about. And, of course, my suggestion to our listeners is do everything you can to keep the fluoride out of the drinking water. And then if you can't, you're going to have to protect yourself and your family. And then, of course, try to use this as an opportunity to educate other people about what's going on. And the tragedy is most doctors and most dentists have never heard of this. And you can get scientific papers if you want the information. It's been thoroughly studied. In fact, it's very well covered in Dr. Blaylock's book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, which is available through Radio Liberty. Or we have many of the original scientific studies, and we can put you in touch with people who will get them for you. And your job is to get to your doctor and your dentist and get them aware of what's going on. I think that once people understand what they're doing, there's going to be quite a backlash. But in the meantime, you really can't afford to wait, because we know that certainly women get, especially postmenopausal women, get a tremendous increase in the incidence of hip fractures, almost double in areas where the water is fluoridated. These are postmenopausal women who are taking the fluoride when they're going through the menopause itself. So the last thing we want is more in the way of osteoporosis. Well, we're going to be bringing our station back on, our stations back up in the Great Northwest, and they'll be coming on here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. But our guest this evening is Jim Shepherd. We're talking about the Berkey Light Water Filter System and, of course, the Big Berkey. All right. Well, let's see. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question for Jim, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Well, Jim, is there some other features we ought to talk about as far as our listeners are concerned?
Well, actually, there was one thing I did want to mention, and it's kind of a takeoff from your comment that you don't have to boil the water. And, oh, boy, this phone is starting to... I'm on a phone that sounds like the battery's going out on it, so I might have to cut this short.
All right, fine.
But with respect to viral contamination in the water, if now the neither filter will remove viruses from the water, then typically a virus will not live for longer than 24 hours in the water. If there is a fear, though, that there is there could be some raw sewage that's in the water, or and there is that there might be viral contamination, then we would recommend that you put 16 drops of Clorox per gallon of water into the water to pre-treat it. And then you run that through the filter system, and the Black Berkey will remove the chlorine from the water entirely, as well as the trihomethylenes, which are generated, which occurs any time that you put chlorine in the water. And these are carcinogenic compounds that that are a byproduct. And it will also remove any taste and odor entirely. So in the event that there is a situation where there might be viral contamination, then that is the solution.
And, of course, basically what you do is you put the Clorox in. It'll destroy the viruses. And then, of course, when it goes through the filters, why the filters filter out the chlorine, and you've got potable water. So that's a pretty slick method of approaching it.
Yeah, and so, of course, the other thing is you can always boil the water, and then you can cool it off and run it through the filters. But any time that you suspect that there might be viral contamination, and again, viruses will not live for typically longer than 24 hours, if that much. But that's how you remedy that. And where you find that kind of situation is if you were in a river or something like that and there was raw sewage being dropped into the river and you were downstream of that, then you'd want to take that precaution.
Okay, well, it sounds like that old telephone of yours there is beginning to beep and not too happy.
Yeah, if you want to call me back on the other line that you have, we could do that. Or if we're wrapped up, I'll just follow your lead.
All right, fine. Well, if we don't have any callers, so I'll tell you what I think I'll do. I'll just let you go. And again, our guest this evening has been Jim Shepherd. And, of course, if you'd like more information on these water filters, first of all, go to my website at radioliberty.com, and you could actually see them there. That's radioliberty.com, and we have all of our information we got from Jim. He was good enough to let us put some of the information from his website there, and you can actually see the various items and make a decision about that. And Jim, thanks so very much for being with us. It's pretty appreciate your willingness to come on.
Always a pleasure to be on your show, Dr.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Jim Shepherd, and I just think that it's something everybody would seriously want to think about if you're interested in getting any other information on how to get the various items you would need in case of a catastrophic event. Now, the average American is unaware of the fact that we've entered World War III. However, the head of the Mossad was on 60 Minutes 2, maybe about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and he said we're in World War III. Certainly, James Woolsey, who was head of the CIA as part of the PNAC group, refers to it World War IV that we're in. And you have to understand that we are going to, of course, to go to war with North Korea if they don't completely give up their nuclear program. The plans are already being made to condition the American people for the war with Syria, if Syria does not agree to all of our demands, which would mean the total loss of their sovereignty. Now, if you wonder where the weapons of mass destruction are, they were moved to Syria weeks, perhaps even longer, before our attack on Iraq. And our government knew that they had been moved to Syria, but we couldn't tell the American people because we had to have an excuse for going in there. But I'd confirm this from our friend Joel Skousen, who has access to information from many sources in government, and of course the same thing from Dor Gold, the former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations. I interviewed, and he's written a wonderful book, which you should read. It's called Hatred's Kingdom, which incidentally Radio Liberty does carry that book. It goes into, of course, Saudi Arabia and how they've been financing Al-Qaeda both before and after September 11th. And, of course, they've simply been our surrogate and helping as far as this whole situation is concerned. Well, we'll talk more about this, and we're going to have open lines the next hour here at Radio Liberty. So we'll be back in just a moment. And, of course, telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But the plan is there. You can read it, certainly, at their website, which is newamericancentury.org. And we'll talk about all of these things. That whatever you want to, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course, what most people don't know, and this is great tragedy, is that a small group of people have really taken over the executive branch of our government. And those of you who haven't heard me talk about this before, why, of course, it's a group known as the Project for the New American Century. In the spring of 1997, and everything I'm telling you comes from their website, newamericancentury.org, and of course you can get all of this information in our syllabus, which we've simply pulled down off of their website. It's called Iraq, the Untold Story. But in the spring of 1997, a group of 25 people got together, including Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, William J. Bennett, the man who wrote the Book of Virtues and then spends his weekends gambling at the resorts all across America, dropping $300,000 or $400,000 on a weekend, having lost over $8 million gambling. This is the author of the Book of Virtues, which is widely circulated by Christian certainly of ministries across America. And then, of course, Gary Bauer, Frank Gaffney, Jeb Bush. And if you have any question about what I'm saying, you go to their website and get their information, or it is all available in our syllabus. But they got together and they said, now, how are we going to change America? America should lead the world. We're the most powerful nation in the world. And, of course, we're going to lead the world. Now, this is long before the attack on the World Trade Center. And you have to understand that both under the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, under the Clinton administration, the terrorists had been given a get-out-of-jail-free card. Nothing was done to stop them. In fact, any effort on the part of FBI agents to investigate the terrorist was effectively thwarted. Now, the FBI was watching that. They had the certain components of the FBI had actually infiltrated the whole terrorist movement. They knew their every motion. They were watching what they were doing. But, of course, they weren't allowed to do anything about it. They knew that the movement was being largely funded by the United States, through the United States, through the Holy Land Foundation and many other Muslim organizations. Much of this is covered in a testimony before the United States Senate Intelligence Committee in 1996, and if you want to read that testimony, it's available in a book called American Jihad, written by Stephen Emerson. And you'll certainly want to get that book and read it, because it goes into the fact that so much of the funding of Hamas and Hezbollah and even Al-Qaeda was coming right out of the United States, that the people that were within this organization, the Al-Qaeda organization, man like Azam, who was allowed to come to the United States and advocate murder and mayhem here at meetings. And, of course, they were actually filmed, I suspect, by undercover FBI agents. And all that information was given to Stephen Emerson to try to get it out to the American people. But when Stephen Emerson put together a video, it was called Jihad in America, and, of course, it was circulated, was shown one time on PBS in 1994, and then somebody gave an order, somebody who had enough clout to control what we see on television. That film was never again to be seen on American television, because it simply had all these video pictures of these Islamic leaders coming to the United States and actually, of course, fomenting jihad in America. They had their training camps here. They were training their Islamic radicals how to use guns and make bombs. All of this was well known before. I mean, where do you think that was 2 days after, the day after the September 11th attack, they were able to arrest 1,200 or 1,400 people immediately, and most of them were deported? Well, because they'd been watching them all along, of course, and they'd been listening to their telephone conversations through the National Security Administration. How do you think it was within 2 hours of the September 11th attack, according to the testimony given before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the 18th of September of last year, the testimony by Kristen Breitweiser? How could it be that within 2 hours of the attack, according to the New York Times, that the FBI was at the restaurants where the hijackers ate, at the schools where they trained, at the neighborhoods where they lived? If we had no idea the attack was coming, how could they possibly have done that? Now, it's very interesting. My understanding is that even though this was testimony given at the open session of the Intelligence Committee, it has subsequently been classified. I do not know that to be a fact, but of course, if you go to my website and look up my October 2002 newsletter, why, of course, you'll find the complete text of Kristen Breitweiser's testimony, which was effectively censored by the controlled media in the United States. You need to get it. You need to read it. You need to put it down, pull it down. You need to make copies of it. You need to distribute it to all of your friends. And you must understand that the FBI knew who all of these people were within 2 hours of the attack. Oh, come on now. They didn't even use, their names didn't even appear on the flight manifesto. How could they possibly know who they were? And that was a question Kristen Breitweiser asked before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And is that why they have reclassified her testimony, which was given in the open? I might comment that I had called the Senate Intelligence Committee a number of times. I think I had to call 4 times before I finally found somebody who worked for the Intelligence Committee who would actually send me the full text of what was said. Now, we got it from them on 2 occasions. We got it down off the Internet, so we know it's accurate. We know what Kristen Breitweiser said, and you can get that from my website at radioliberty.com. But you have an obligation to find out if it's true. And then you have an obligation to help us get the information out, because I can only reach a certain number of people. You can reach people all the time. And even if they don't want to hear about it, just try to get them to read or listen to some of our programs. Or I have a great video. It's called 9/11 Contrived. It goes into the fact that there were so many opportunities to apprehend Osama bin Laden, both before and after the 9/11 attack. In fact, even during the Afghan War, there were many times opportunities to get him, and we refused. In fact, we even quote from an article in the Washington Times that quotes a high government official who said, "We're not trying to get Osama bin Laden. We have a policy not of Osama bin Laden first, but Osama bin Laden last. Because here and during this war, if we got Osama bin Laden, how would we justify continuing the war? How would we justify continuing the war?" You get the exact quotation down off my website, and we have the article. Of course, we keep these, and we'll make copies for anybody who's skeptical and really doesn't believe what we're saying. So you have to understand, and then this wonderful article out of the Newsweek magazine about the Northern Alliance that had this group of 1,000 al-Qaeda, the wicked al-Qaeda, cornered, and of course Osama bin Laden was supposedly with him, and they were just about to close in and liquidate this 1,000 al-Qaeda when what should happen? But out of the sky comes a squadron of black helicopters and scoops up all the al-Qaeda, presumably with Osama bin Laden, and they're whisked away. And of course, when the Northern Alliance complained and said, what were you doing there? Why the Americans said, well, those were our helicopters, but we were just dropping off and picking up special forces, that's all. But all the al-Qaeda disappeared at that time. Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen, that nothing we're told is really true, that everything is an illusion, that we're living in the world of Jim Carrey and the Truman Show? Well, let me give you a few examples. As we've got a few minutes here, of course, I would love to have your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But there's so much more that we just never get a chance to talk about. Have you ever stopped and wondered about the attack on Iraq? This was truly one of the most amazing military feats of all time. And of course, the most amazing thing is that Donald Rumsfeld, who was one of the original members of this PNAC group that laid out the plan in 1997 on how they were going to take over our government, Donald Rumsfeld was in total conflict with all of our generals, who said we'd need another 100,000 men to be successful. We had to have a maximum military force if we wanted to be successful and be able to, occupy this country. And Donald Rumsfeld said, "No, you're all wrong. I know we are going to go in with this limited force, and we're not going to meet, in essence, any resistance. We're going to go right into Baghdad." And the general said, "You can't do it." And Donald Rumsfeld said, "I can." And the most amazing thing, the Iraqis didn't mine the roads going in. They didn't blow up any of the roads. They didn't even blow up the bridges going off across the Euphrates River to impede our advance. We had, of course, total control of the skies. The Iraqis had over 100 planes that they could have put in the sky at any time they wanted to. What were they saving them for? Why didn't they put their planes in the sky? Now, maybe they would have been shot down. Certainly our planes were far superior to theirs. But, you know, you would think that they would have tried to put the planes in the air, at least maybe to attack our helicopters, because the helicopters, and many times there'd be helicopters there and nothing else in the sky guarding them, the helicopters would have been sitting ducks. But not one Iraqi fired a plane, to my knowledge, was in the sky. What were they saving them for the next war when Saddam Hussein comes back again, or maybe nothing as it appears to be? They were apparently surface-to-air missiles, so SAM missiles that they could have used. They couldn't have taken out our fighter planes, but they certainly could have taken out our helicopters, and none of them were used. They had a very effective anti-tank weapons that, of course, were Soviet-made. None of those were used on our tanks. And then, of course, they didn't blow up the airfield. There was an airfield just outside of Baghdad. And remember, it was 12 miles outside. And, of course, once we had that airfield, why we could have gone ahead and we could begin to bring in supplies. And, of course, the big problem was the long supply lines we had. But once we could use that airfield, then, of course, we could use that to supply our troops in Baghdad. So why didn't they blow up the airfield? There were all sorts of tunnels underneath. They could have at least blown up a couple of the runways so that we couldn't have used them and incapacitated the airfield. And they didn't do any of the logical things that you would have anticipated. And then orders were given to the Republican Guard, these people dedicated, ready to fight to the death for their homeland. They were told to go home by their generals. Now, what sort of arrangement was made? Nobody's told us. But obviously there was some sort of a secret arrangement made. Where is this Saddam Hussein and certainly his leading generals? There are stories of which you will never read in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, but you will read them in the Washington Times, which incidentally gets a lot of leaks from the CIA, that they, of course, have been given French passports, and many of them are off living in Europe today. I don't know whether that's true or not. I do know, number one, there have been at least three articles we have that come from the Washington Times making that statement, making that charge. I do know that these articles have been censored from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and, of course, the Wall Street Journal, which I read and read religiously, and from our local newspapers, and, of course, the magazines across America. Now, how can they censor that? How can they have that source in one newspaper and nothing else? Well, because we have censorship in America. If you don't read the Washington Times, you would never know this. Is it possible that the French actually did this? The French actually gave them the passports? I'm not saying it happened. I'm just asking, what happened to Saddam Hussein? How did he just sort of mysteriously disappear? And why is it that we seem to have about as much interest in finding Saddam Hussein as we have in finding the wicked Osama bin Laden? And, of course, as we pointed out repeatedly, and Joel Skousen, who's a frequent guest on that program, has pointed out, he knows of at least three instances since the 9/11 attack when people have come from Pakistan. They've made appointments to see people in our Defense Department to tell them exactly where where Osama bin Laden was hiding in Pakistan, because there's a $25 million reward for him. And nobody in the Defense Department wants to do anything at all. They do not want to get Osama bin Laden. Why? Well, because if we got Osama bin Laden, how could we justify all the loss of freedom here at home? After all, we have to have the USA Patriot Act 1 and the USA Patriot Act 2 and do away with the sunshine provisions of USA Patriot Act 1. The sunshine provisions mean that the law goes away. And they can no longer have these draconian federal laws for a federal Gestapo that are being imposed on the American people today. Well, of course, we're told that all these new laws have to do with catching the wicked terrorists. And yet, just within the last 2 weeks, a number of Democratic legislatures from Texas felt that they were being misused, that the Republicans controlled the House there, a legislative house in Texas. They were going to put it through a redistricting system, which was totally unfair. And so the Democratic legislators fled the state so they couldn't get a quorum, so they couldn't allow the Republicans to do something which they felt was grossly unfair and unjust. Now, this is a state issue. It has nothing to do with Osama bin Laden and the wicked terrorists has nothing to do with anything in the federal government. And yet, of course, the Office of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge's Office of Homeland Security, was notified and mobilized to track down the wicked Democratic legislators who'd fled the state, and these are the sort of foolish little games that they play in legislatures, and part of Robert's Rules of Order. If you don't have a quorum, you can't have a vote. The Office of Homeland Security has been used to track down drug users and of course dishonest lawyers and all sorts of things having nothing to do with terrorism. And you must understand this legislation, the anti-terrorist legislation, the Office of Homeland Security, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, none of these have anything to do with Islamic terrorism. They have to do with converting America from a free society into an all-powerful centralized society where all power is located in Washington, D.C., and you have a federal Gestapo, you militarize our local police and you bring our local police under the control of the central authority. You, of course, can then use the military for police against the citizens, and you do away with the Posse Comitatus laws, all in the name of fighting the wicked terrorists. And that's why we can't, of course, get Osama bin Laden, because how would you get the American people to go along with this? Now, obviously, there isn't much of a terrorist threat. We have not had any serious terrorist attacks in America since, of course, the anthrax attack, which the government knew was coming, because Dick Cheney, on the evening of September 11, 2001, and his whole staff went on Cipro specific treatment for anthrax. They obviously knew or suspected the attack was coming. Gee, I wonder why they didn't tell anybody else it was coming. But be that as it may, other than this a bomb that went off at Yale a couple of days ago and didn't do any damage, it didn't kill anybody at all, it was set off in an empty building. And, of course, there's nothing to tie this into Islamic terrorism. There have been no terrorist attacks on the United States. You know, we really have this terrorist threat here. Sure, there was a terrorist threat. But they knew who all the terrorists were, and they arrested them all, and they deported most of them. But they can't tell you that. They can't admit that we'd infiltrated the Islamic movement here. In fact, two of the hijackers were living with an FBI informant. Gee, how did that happen? And they just couldn't figure out where they were. Why were these people not on the terrorist list? Most of them were on the terrorist list. At least six of them were on the terrorist list, were stopped on the morning of the 11th of September, and three others were stopped and detained at the airports because they were with people on the terrorist list. Now, let me give you September 11th. We were on maximum alert all across the country. I mean, they knew an attack was coming. The FBI and the CIA had been told by the Moroccan Secret Service, by the Jordanian Secret Service, by the Mossad, and by the Germans, by Putin, that the attack was coming. It was coming in America. And yet, you know, of course, George Tenet of the CIA and Louis Free, neither one of them had any idea. I guess by that time, of course, we had Robert Mueller who'd just come in. He was, of course, Janet Reno's appointee, who was the chief prosecutor in Northern California. He was the man that Janet Reno had appointed, and isn't it interesting that George Bush selected him to head the CIA, the FBI? Either Janet Reno was incredibly stupid or foolish selecting a good conservative, pro-American individual for a job working for her, or George Bush was misled when he selected Robert Mueller to head the FBI. But we can't really blame Mueller for what happened. We certainly can blame Louis Free, and we can blame George Tenet. They both knew the attack was coming, and nothing, absolutely nothing was done. Our airports were not on high alert. I mean, the military was on high alert, but somebody grounded all the planes that morning, and our Joel Skousen has contact with people who actually talked to people with at the airports who were told all military planes had to be grounded. Now, who would have given an order like that? Who would have given an order that no American fighter planes were to be put in the air to intercept the hijacked planes? And for an hour and 40 minutes from the time the first plane was hijacked until the last plane crashed into the Pentagon, for almost an hour and 40 minutes. Well, one of the planes was flying a loop-to-loop around the Pentagon. no American fighter planes were mobilized. I mean, the planes at Andrews Air Force Base, where there were planes ready to go, they could have been there in Washington, D.C. in 2 hours, but orders were given that nothing was to be done to stop them. And, of course, nine of the hijackers were stopped at the airport that morning. We have the articles on that. And nothing was done to interdict them, to keep them from, of course, going ahead and boarding the planes and then, of course, crashing them into buildings. Is it possible that this was a planned, catastrophic, and catalytic event, like a Pearl Harbor aimed at bringing America into World War III? Well, let me suggest, as we started out this conversation, talking about the website, it's called newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org, and you can get it on your website or get, of course, much of the material from our ministry by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But if you go to the website and pull down their Rebuilding America's Defenses report, it's about 95 pages, something like that. And, of course, there I believe it's on page 51. And don't hold me to that, but I believe it's on page 51. They talk about the coming transformation of the American Armed Forces. And everything, of course, we're going to transform the American Armed Forces. We're going to have our military stationed throughout the world like the cavalry on the new American frontier. And, of course, the whole idea, we're going to have a Pax Americana, we're going to have an American empire. We're going to regulate and control the whole world. That's what the report, in essence, says. But on page 51, it says this transformation of the American military will take some time unless, and these are their words, there was a catastrophic and catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor. Let me repeat that. Unless there is a catastrophic and catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor. Well, that was, of course, the report was put out in September of the year 2000, just 12 months before the attack on the World Trade Center. And, of course, Dick Cheney, now the vice president at that time, he was president of Halliburton Oil, Halliburton Company, Halliburton, which recently got a $600 or $700 million contract to work in Iraq. Nobody knows what it's going to do, but they're going to get that. But you'll be very glad to know that Dick Cheney is still getting $160,000 every year from Halliburton in the form of deferred salary. Does that bother you that Dick Cheney is getting $160,000 a year today from a company he used to work for that just got a massive government contract with no bidding at all? Is there anybody out there who might think that at least this might have the appearance of something that isn't quite right? Well, let me tell you, most of the things going on are quite right, and Bechtel's getting big contracts, and all of the favored international corporations are getting these contracts without any bidding at all. We might be able to get the job done a lot cheaper elsewhere, but of course you can be sure that the friends of Dick Cheney will, of course, get the prime contracts. Well, anyway, Dick Cheney, immediately after the September 11th attack, now, by this time, he's the Vice President of the United States. He's part of this little group, though, that put out the report talking about, well, we need or we will not get the transformation of our military unless, of course, there is a catastrophic and catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor. Pull it down off the web. Read it. Find it. And get people to read it, please. Try to get them to understand. And Dick Cheney, the Sunday after the attack, said, you know, we knew an attack was coming, but who would have ever thought it would be something like this? Well, of course, anybody who's ever analyzed things, the government had a number of reports talking about how there was a plan to hijack our planes and crash them into our buildings. And if you get Kristen Breitweiser's testimony or Eleanor Hill's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the 18th of September of last year, and we have all of this available for anybody who can't get it off the Internet, it's through my ministry at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. But it's there, and Eleanor Hill and Kristen Breitweiser both gave example after example after example after example of the fact that there were plans to hijack our planes and crash them into our buildings. In fact, there was about 6 or 8 months before the September 11th attack, a program, and it was a takeoff on the X-Files, was the group known as the Lone Gunman. There were these three computer experts who always would help Mulder on the X-Files. And they had their own program for a short period of time. And of course, this one time they were flying across the Atlantic Ocean on their way into New York. And of course, the controls on their plane were taken over by some wicked group on the ground. So that they couldn't fly the plane. The computer was flying the plane. And you know where it was headed? It was headed to the World Trade Center. And of course, the whole program centers around them trying to regain control of the controls of the plane so they can avoid it from crashing into the building. And of course, this thing is foolproof. There's no way to do it. But the master computer hackers are able, of course, to hack into the computer program. And just as they're about to crash into the World Trade Center, you know, of course, with a plane loaded with fuel, why, of course, they're able to get the nose up and just skirt the top of the building, and everybody lives happily ever after. Maybe Dick Cheney should watch some of these television programs that tell him exactly what was going to happen. Or, you know, of course, there was a fascinating book. It was called Target America. It was published in 1993. It was written by a man, Joseph Podansky. The book was called Target America. And, of course, it told the same story that Podansky told, and you can go to your library and get this, New Yorker Magazine, September 24th, I believe it is, of the year 2001, just a couple of weeks after the September 11th attack. And Podansky said in that, of course, article there, that he knew, and it was well known, that the Iranians in the early 1980s, had set up a base in Iran with 747s and 707s, where they were training the terrorists to hijack American planes so they could be crashed into American buildings. Now, one of the most interesting things about that book was it was suppressed exactly as Stephen Emerson's video, Jihad in America, was suppressed. And you couldn't buy that book any place. Somebody must have bought up all the copies, because I couldn't get a copy anywhere in the United States a few years ago when I tried to get it. I had to get my copy out of England, I think for $25, but the title was Attack of the West in America. So somebody bought up those articles, those books, in my opinion, and they did it for a specific purpose. Why? So the American people wouldn't know that there was a plan to do exactly what happened. And, of course, in fact, even Bill Gertz from the Washington Times had written an article we have on July 12th, before the September 11th attack, talking about Operation Bajinka and the plan to hijack planes and crash them, among other things, into the World Trade Center. But, you know, when I talked to Bill Gertz, who, incidentally, is very well known because he has all this inside information he gets from the CIA, when I interviewed him and I said on his book he'd written on September 11th, and I said, gee, that was a great book, Bill, and that was a great scoop you had. I mean, here 2 months ahead of time, you're talking about hijacking our planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center. And he didn't even remember writing it. I said, I have your article. Oh, no, no, I never wrote it. I said, Bill, I got it, on September 12th or 13th, under your byline, your article. Well, he denied any knowledge of ever writing that. Somebody, of course, is altering what we think and believe. And you need to help us. If you value America, you value your freedom and your fruits and your family, why, of course, give serious thought to joining Radio Liberty. Give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Check the facts and help us to get the truth out across America while there's still time. Till tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, we're going to have with us this evening John Turner, who was worked for the IRS for many years and quit about the same time Joe Bannister did, because he realized, of course, that the whole IRS system was corrupt and wrong and illegal. Now, we're not suggesting that anybody in the audience not pay their income tax. I've known too many people who've got caught up in this whole enthusiasm and saying it's wrong, it was unconstitutional, the bill was never passed, and of course you don't have to pay your income tax. And they will come after you. In fact, I'm firmly convinced that some of the people advocating this are really there to get people so wound up in trying to fight the system that they can't be effective in any other way. My advice to you is to pay your income tax and to put your efforts and your time into helping us educate the American people. But it's important you know about the corrupt system that has been put on us. It was actually sold to the American people back in 1913 as, you know, a means of taxing the very wealthy. It was this whole idea, well, it's only for people who are very, very wealthy. After, if we were just to take maybe 3% of what they have so much, and they could give it to the people, the poor people. And of course, the whole idea of the politics of envy, we'll use the power of government. We'd never take more than 3% of their income. But of course, we don't want to put that in, because if we put that in, automatically the taxes will go up to 3%, so we won't put a lid on it because we don't want it to go that high. Well, of course, it was never intended, of course, to tax the wealthy. It was always intended, of course, to tax the middle class. And, of course, an incredible, incredible scam. You hear all these stories. Oh, of course, all these taxes, they're primarily paid by the rich. But, of course, they never point out that everybody, of course, is paying a good deal of money through Social Security and Medicare. And, of course, their employer has to put it in. That's 15% of income. And that is all being used as a tax. It's not being put into a fund for you. There is no lockbox. You are paying that, and that's being spent to cover current expenses. And they're simply lying to you when they tell you there is a Social Security fund. There is a IOU from the government to pay money that they do not have and they never will have. And, of course, eventually the whole thing's going to collapse. But, of course, everything is an illusion. I mean, they want to tell you, of course, it's only the rich that are paying now. That's the way it's designed. The poor aren't going to pay. But the poor are paying, of course, the 15% of their income money, of course, which is a tax. And of course, but let's get to John. You don't want to hear me going on. John, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Hi, Stan.
Well, why don't you tell us how long you worked for the IRS, what you did for the IRS, and why you finally got disillusioned and gave up a good paying job with all the securities and the benefits and perks that come with being part of the corrupt system.
Sure. I worked for the IRS from 1987 through part of 1997. I actually resigned in during tax filing season April of 1997, so I worked there about 10 years. I was basically assigned as a revenue officer during that entire time with the what was then called the Sacramento District, later called the Northern California District. So basically up here in the Sacramento area is where I did most of my revenueing. And revenue officers are the enforcement officers at the civil level for the IRS. Their business is to try to compel people to pay their taxes, their delinquent taxes, and or file delinquent tax returns. And of course that entails a lot, but it's the revenue officer who does the things that is IRS is so famous for. You know, they make property seizures and bank account seizures and such. And of course, one of the things that revenue officers are trained to do is to be aware of what the IRS calls badges of fraud. And so if the revenue officer has reason to believe that a certain taxpayer is engaged in some activity that they would consider fraudulent, he's supposed to write a report up and substantiate it thoroughly enough so that the when he makes a referral to the criminal investigation division for one of their agents to work the case, they'll be enticed from a well-written report to go ahead and work that criminal case.
All right, fine. So then you were the one who would put in the report on people. Would you actually participate in seizing their property, seizing their bank accounts?
Closing their business. Yeah, I would write up the paperwork to do that. Take with me another revenue officer if it was the day to actually go out and make a seizure. Levies on wages and bank accounts are nothing more than a piece of paper going to the employer or the banker. However, seizures of vehicles and houses and businesses and physical property requires another revenue officer to go with me and you know, as a pair, and to deliver the paperwork and actually secure the property and do all those things to take it into government possession.
Well, now, of course, would you then put a lock on the office door, things like that?
Yeah, if it was, say, a business with an overhead, a retail, like a shop or a store or something, or a doctor's office or whatever, we'd have to hire a third party, a vendor, a locksmith, to come and change the lock so that we could, you know, control the situation from that point on after the seizure.
But of course, if you were to lock the doctor's office, why, he couldn't practice, he could never pay you back the money owed you.
Yeah, and sometimes that really has some devastating effects. I think a lot of times what it does do, in actuality, it causes whatever, whoever the taxpayer is, whatever business they're in, it causes them to start talking in a more positive way with the IRS because of their obvious disadvantage that they're in, and trying to work something out to change that situation so that they can go back to work if they're a doctor, take care of patients.
Well, do they target prominent people to try to intimidate everybody else? I had a friend of mine who was a professor of surgery, one of the world's most eminent transplant surgeons, and of course he was the professor at a major Eastern university, and he was targeted by the IRS, and they spent, I don't know, millions of dollars trying to convict him, embarrass him, humiliate him, and of course they didn't have a case. They obviously they lost the case eventually, but you know, will they target people simply to intimidate everybody else?
Well, yeah, part of what goes into a good criminal referral, a good target, somebody that they believe they can go all the way through and convict them if at all possible, they take into consideration the amount of tax revenues that they believe are not being paid. They take into account that person's standing, if he's a professional or if he's a celebrity, something like that, prominent. All those things can make for a good case or a bad case, depending on the actual situation. You know, sometimes the IRS has closed down daycare centers, a little mom and pop business that's taking care of people's children who go off to work and leave their children in their care, and they've closed down business like that, and that usually is it leaves a lot of bad PR for the IRS. So they're very careful about who they pick on, and obviously, some people are better candidates than others.
Well, they certainly went after Leona Hemsley, and you know, I think she paid $56 million instead of $57 million in income tax, and they really you know, they were going to they actually ended up sending her to jail.
Yeah. They it's interesting. You know, they love to get increased PR and publicity from prominent people like that. It's an effective deterrent for citizens at large who read about it and hear about it on the TV, read about it in the newspaper. Nowadays, hearing about it on the internet, so-and-so, you know, put in jail. This is the effect in the minds of people, is what the government wants. Hey, this is what happens if you you don't pay your taxes.
All right, fine. So a lot of it is just fear and intimidation. Well, Kirsten, why did you give up a good-paying job? You know, and of course, another 10 years, you probably could have had a pension secured and lived comfortably the rest of your life on the government pension. How long do you have to work for the IRS before you get your pension?
Well, you can't retire with a full pension prior to being age 55.
Well, Chris, but I mean, you could get at least partial pension, couldn't you?
Yeah, you could get a 20-year retirement. I had military time, and so I would have been able to retire with a pretty decent little pension, a retirement account. And, you know, I actually liked the job. I mean, there were things obviously about it. Every revenue officer had things about the job that he didn't like, but overall, I liked the job. I mean, otherwise, I wouldn't have done it for 10 years. Things I liked about it was the fact that I loved people, and I was dealing with people. People who had problems, and people who felt intimidated, afraid. They had procrastinated, most of them, to get to the situation they're in, and I knew that. And rather than try to take great advantage of that, I just try to be straightforward people, help them out with their problems, and get them to where, you know, life could get back on an even keel for them. It wasn't always possible, but for most people, it was. And
did you have any right to barter with them or to decrease the amount of money if they owed, if they would come up with money?
Sure, yeah. There's only a few ways that the collection officer for the IRS has to close a case that he's got as a field officer at the, you know, local level with taxpayers there in his area. You can collect full payment if that's possible, whether it's done by the taxpayer voluntarily finding a way to make a remittance through a check or something, or whether it's done through enforcement, seizing and levying. Full payment is obviously the aim that they're looking for as their first priority, but percentage-wise, only a few people are actually able to do that. So the revenue officer cannot just keep an unlimited amount of cases that are not going to pay in his inventory forever. You have to find ways to be able to resolve his cases because there's always more coming to him. And so one of the things is, hey, some people, they cannot pay at all, nothing, at the time that the revenue officer is convening with this person. He reviews their financial information, and the only way they maybe could pay something is if they defaulted on their mortgage or didn't have the food they need to feed their children. And the IRS does not purposely try to put people in that situation. So sometimes some people just have an administrative solution that says, for the time being, we're not going to pursue collection. The penalties and interest will still accrue, but there won't be any active collection at this time. Maybe in the future we'll renew the investigation and see if your situation is more favorable. Then there is the installment payment plan, where you can review your financial information, and maybe you can't fully pay, but maybe you're not, you shouldn't just not pay anything. And so on a case-by-case basis, they try to work with people, and if they think you can pay $200-$300 a month according to your ability, then they'll set a person up to do that. And then what's very popular and has been for the last 10 or so years since they liberalized the criteria of the program, and that is called offer and compromise. The offer and compromise program is what some people hear now advertised on radio and television. Law firms like to publicize that you can pay the IRS pennies on the dollar, which is a reality. It can be done. It's not for everybody. There are criteria that people have to meet, but for the people who are able to meet the criteria, it's an excellent way for them to take what normally is a hopeless situation. They may never, ever in a lifetime be able to pay the tax bill that they have. And if they can get a successful offer and compromise accepted by the IRS, then what that does, it takes all of the debt that's not paid. In other words, they make an offer of a certain amount, whether it's a lump sum or monthly payments for a limited period of time, 2 or 3 years. And at that point, whatever has not been paid, and it may be very, very substantial still, at that point, the government writes off that amount permanently. The slate is wiped clean. tax liens are released, and basically people's only obligation at that point is to continue filing and paying timely, and then that in that situation they won't have the everything come undone and be back to square one, in other words.
Howard, well, I had a friend of mine, a very, very famous writer, his name was Professor Anthony Sutton, and of course about 1998, maybe about the year 2000, he gets a letter from the IRS saying, you didn't pay your taxes in 1985, and therefore you owe us all this money for 1985 because you didn't file an income tax form and didn't pay any money that year. Can they actually go back that far?
Yeah, they can. Now, they have a policy, in effect, that still is and has been for several years now. It basically says, with respect to people who haven't filed, they're only going to go back generally 6 years, as long as there's fraud doesn't seem to be involved. So if it's just a typical procrastinator person, somebody who hasn't filed returns for a few years, unless they have some other extenuating circumstances that they think should change it, they're generally not going to ask people who have been out of the system but decide they want to get back into the system to file beyond the 6 years.
Well, actually, he had paid his taxes. He was simply a very critical of the government, and they were just for some reason or other, he'd paid his taxes every year.
Uh-huh.
Of course, he had the tax forms, he had the receipts for the money he had paid, but they went back 10 years, and so many people probably don't keep their income tax forms and all the checks for that long a period of time.
Right. Yeah, if you're talking about people who have already filed and paid, and now the IRS is going to audit and revisit the tax year involved. Generally, unless there's fraud involved, they only have 3 years from that date when that tax return is filed to go back. That's the general rule. So and that's a statutory thing. It's not a policy or anything. It's an actual law. You file your 1985 return in April of 1986, and then in 1995, they want to go back and audit that 85 return. Unless they believe and can prove fraud, they're not allowed to do that.
Well, of course, how can they prove it if they don't have the forms? They can say we don't. Of course, if they have the forms, they allege fraud and then do it? Do they have to have proof of fraud before?
Well, they have to have a probable cause. They have to have good indicator that fraud was, a willfulness involved there with omitting income and therefore omitting tax that should have been paid.
Well, I got a call recently from a gentleman who told me, he said he had just gotten a letter from the IRS asking if he lived at this address, and this is, who he was. And I said, well, why are they doing that? He said, I haven't paid any taxes for 7 years. What should I do? And my suggestion to him was get a good lawyer and try to work out something with him. Because, of course, if you don't, they're going to make your life miserable. Would that be good advice? What should you do if, let's imagine you fell into this whole idea of, oh, I'm not going to pay my taxes, I don't like the system, the 16th Amendment wasn't passed legally, and then suddenly down the line, seven years later, why, of course, they come up and they say, look, you haven't paid your taxes, you owe us for all these years. What do you do at that point?
Yeah, the general advice that you gave him is solid advice. Most people that have been working for any number of years, I mean, most of us have assets. Most people, they've worked, they've accumulated property. Most people have a spouse, children, mortgages, college educations to pay for. I mean, we could just add to the list, but the point is, you have a lot to lose. And so a person that often finds themselves in that situation, even if they're, as you say, somebody who had a conviction in their minds from a study and a good faith belief that they were not a person required, that no law required them to file income tax returns on their personal labor, if it worked out that they were finally subject to an investigation where it looked like they were going to lose everything they had worked their whole life to accumulate, then sure, most people, they don't want to do that. So good advice is to either on your own or get good counsel, whether it's a lawyer or whether it's a CPA or whether it's somebody like myself as an enrolled agent. Those three professionals, if they're competent, can equip people to deal with scary situations.
This is what you actually do, is you consult with people then who are in that sort of situation?
Right, that's correct.
All right, fine. And so people can contact you. How would people get hold of you if they wanted to?
Well, they can email me at the following email address, T-I-M-E, that's time, and the number 4, and my initials JT, so that is time4jt@att.net.
All right, that's time4jt@att.net. And I hope none of our listeners out there need that, but it's a good source of reference. Well, how did it happen then? Why did you finally leave the IRS?
Well, as I said, I enjoyed my job. I wasn't looking to go anywhere. On the one hand, I couldn't see myself getting really, really old doing that job because it's kind of an active job. You go out and it's confrontational. On the other hand, doing what I did, I didn't find it extremely objectionable. I like the challenge of helping people. And so for 10 years, I'm just content doing that job. And all of a sudden, I'm greeted at my front door one night by my lovely wife. And she takes me hastily to the dinner table. We eat our meal rather hastily compared to usual. The conversation is brief. And then she tells me at the conclusion, with leaving the table not cleared, she says, "Come here, sit down on the couch. There's something I want you to listen to." So we sat down staring literally at this home entertainment center where she popped in an audio tape for about 20 minutes, just staring at it and listening to this man on this tape who was ranting and raving about the Federal Reserve and our system of money and banking and the IRS and the income tax fraud, and on he went.
Now, who was the man?
His name was, I'm trying to remember his name.
All right, what is it? One of those unforgettable individuals. Anyway, okay, it doesn't really matter. I just thought you might know about him. Anyway, so he's ranting and raving. He's ranting and raving about the Federal Reserve system.
Yeah, he doesn't like our system of money. He doesn't like, our fiat money system. He doesn't like the tax. He believes that the IRS is, not properly following the law, doing what they're doing. And so there was a bit of a business angle pitch in this little tape. It was somewhat of a teaser. Well, my wife had been given this tape, and she listened to it, and she just said, "Well, John works for the IRS. I'll just let him evaluate this." So believe me, she had no idea where it was going to lead, or she would
Would have done it. Never. Women like the security of a regular income.
That's right. But so after it was over, she looked at me, and she says, "What did you think?" And I said, "Well, he was kind of radical." And she says, "No, what did you think about what he said?" And I said, "Well, I didn't hear him say anything that was wrong or illegal or anything. He just clearly doesn't like some things about the government." And she says, "Good, there's this meeting I want you to attend with me 2 nights from now." So 2 nights later, I went straight after work, went straight to Grass Valley, California, and sat in on the front row right at the feet of a man, a different man than who was on the tape, made a presentation, and the room was filled with, 30 to 40 people, and this fella and nobody else knew me there, and he didn't know who I worked for or what I did. And as he got into his presentation saying things like, "You're not required to file income tax returns, you're not required to pay, no law compels you to do that," and on and on, making all these statements, I'm kind of hunkering down in my chair right there on the front row, crossing my arms. My jaw probably was twitching, probably had steam coming out my ear. I mean, I was not very happy with what he was saying. And then he finished his presentation, and he let everybody who needed to go early be dismissed, and he said, "For those of you who can stay around a little longer, get some refreshments, and then come back and let's hear your questions." So after several people, he fielded questions from several people, and the questions pretty much subsided, I took him up on a conversation one by one, one-on-one, just he and myself. And my wife is standing behind me listening to this conversation, and as the conversation went on, three or four or five other people started hanging around listening, and I was asking questions, and he was answering them, but they weren't, you know, my questions were a little different than the ones I had heard from the audience, and I wasn't satisfied with his answers, so we were going around and around in this conversation. And my wife, at one point, she pokes me in the ribs, whispers in my ear, she says, "Hey, this conversation is going nowhere. Why don't you tell him who you work for and what you do, and maybe you can relate, and maybe he'll understand where you're coming from." And I thought, I don't want to tell this guy, you know, who I work for. But then on second thought, I thought, well, you know what, she's right. I'm trying to have an intelligent conversation with this guy, and I'll tell him. So I did, and he kind of stepped back and regrouped. I could tell he was thinking for a second there. And what happened then in the next few minutes was going to change the direction of my life, and I had no idea what was going to happen, of course. But he said, "Look," he says, "Have you ever looked at the laws, the regulations? Have you ever looked at the facts for your own self on a personal basis, so that you can, with documentation, refute the claims that I made tonight?" And then he just shut up and waited for me to answer. And I said, I was kind of, you know, not willing to admit it, but I had to admit, no, I haven't. And Stan, the answer to that is that the IRS trains their agents and all their employees. They just train them with what information they need to do their little job. And they give them rules. They give them procedures. Here's the forms. Here's how you fill out the forms. Don't do this. You'll get in trouble. Don't do that. You'll get your boss in trouble. A little bit of the law, but in little snippets here and there. And so then he said, okay. He says, you know, I've been talking to you here for a few minutes, and he said, you seem pretty intelligent to me. He said, I imagine working for the IRS that you have access to materials and resources that you could start a study and try to get into some of this stuff if you wanted to, right? And I said, yeah. He says, really what it boils down to is, do you have an open mind? Do you have a willingness to do whatever it takes for your own satisfaction to show me where I'm wrong? And then he just shut up again. And I'm standing there, and I'm thinking, all these people are standing there listening, and I'm thinking, man, you know, I'm a government employee. This sounds like a lot of work. And then I'm thinking, but you know what? The guy's, he's right. He's being very sincere. He wasn't being frivolous with me. He wasn't being contentious. And I also thought, you know what? I've been an enforcement officer for 10 years. I'm going out telling people the law says you have to do this and you have to do that, and if you don't do this and do that, the government's charged me with the responsibility of taking certain actions. So when we get back from this break, I'll go ahead and resume this, Stan.
All right, fine. Well, it sounds like a fascinating story, and if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to talk to John, of course. We'll wait about that till we get just a little bit further into more of his story, and then we'll invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And you're going to hear, of course, John's attorney's story of how this one evening changed his life. Maybe we ought to learn something from that. If people don't want to hear what we say, just challenge them to prove that we're wrong. Because if we are wrong, they've got nothing to worry about. If what we say is true, and then, of course, their future, their family, their freedom are at stake. We'll be right back. Well, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is John Turner, and of course we're talking about the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, but Of course, most of the people who work for it are just doing a job. They're making a living. And, of course, they have been told certain things. They believe, well, just like most Americans. You talk to most Americans, they believe we're a democracy. They know we're a democracy. Everybody knows we're a democracy. What's wrong with democracy? And, of course, if you explain to them and you know how to approach it, if you could just get them to understand that they've been told a lie. And, of course, democracy always leads to dictatorship. That's why Karl Marx advocated democracy. And once people begin to understand somebody's been playing games with their minds, then, of course, you can change their whole world out, worldview. Well, anyway, so John is standing here. He's talking to this fellow, and he's challenged him to check the facts and find out where the truth lies. So pick up the story from there, John.
Okay, Stan, thanks. So he's giving me this question of, if I have, he's asking me if I have an open mind enough to do the study required to show him where he's wrong, and he just stood there waiting patiently. I thought about it later, much later, and realized that his tactic with me was normal and natural for him. He was a salesman, and so he, as a salesman, believed and used in that rule that some people are in sales that are familiar with, that, you know, in a closing situation where you're trying to close the deal, the first person to speak loses. And so he asked the question, and then he closed his mouth waiting for me to see what I was going to say. I could have easily said, no, I'm not interested. But truth was, I've always been open-minded. And truth was, as you just said at the beginning of this, after this break, I was doing that job with, a belief that people are required to file and pay taxes. Of course, everybody knows that. And I slept good at night because my conscience was clear. I tried to treat people fairly and honestly, and so that's how I did the job. So he asked me this question, and then I realized that he was serious, and I replied, and I said, okay, yeah, I'll do that, because I really thought, in my naivety, that I would be back shortly with him with photocopies of this and that and the other to show him why he was all wet and why his quote-unquote tax protester beliefs were not valid. And so off I went. I started becoming a voracious reader of many different things. Started with just the tax code itself. You know, we were issued a copy of the tax law, and it sat on my desk, and I occasionally had a need to consult it in the course of doing my job, but like I said earlier, most of our job became routine. We had manuals which were written by employees for different circumstances that the revenue officer would find himself in, and so we would turn to the manual typically for guidance on how to do certain things. And if the manual didn't have all the information we needed for a particular situation, how to resolve it, we would turn to the IRS attorneys and ask them for advice before we moved forward in an unclear manner. So the law wasn't something that you looked at every day for the things that you did as a revenue officer. And here I was now reading it from the beginning, cover to cover, going through, looking for statutes, and then later the regulations to find out, you know, doing all this in my own time after my job and taking vacation days and evenings and weekends, and basically not doing much of anything else for a while, and looking for the clear, unequivocal place in the law that says, you know, where a person becomes liable for the income tax. And about three and a half weeks into that, I started having some uneasy feelings in my stomach. I mean, it was not going very good. It certainly wasn't going the way I anticipated it when I told that fella that I would be glad to show him where he was wrong. And so I continued this. I eventually moved on to, you know, law libraries and other sources, and I even decided that I needed to, early on, I decided I needed to try to talk to people who I knew that there were people out there who were prominent and accessible who were speaking out about the income tax. And so I went and visited with some of those people like Irwin Schiff and Eddie Kane and Lynn Meredith and others, and you know, just confronted them directly, told them who I was, why I was there, and what I wanted to know. And surprisingly, these people were very accessible. They did not shy away. They typically loaded me up with so many things to, you know, they say, here, go read this, go read that, go search that out. Don't take my word for it. Go study this. And so I did. And the more I studied, the more I read, the more rocks I turned over, the worse it got for the IRS, for the way that they're applying the income tax laws to most people. And obviously, as a revenue officer, somebody who every day, a big part of the revenue officer's job is filing notices of lien to protect the property, the government's interest in property, filing levies to attach to people's wages and their bank accounts, and making seizures, and always confronting people and giving them warnings that you're going to take enforcement if they don't comply and do certain things within a certain time frame. That's a daily part of a revenue officer's job, and there was no way, once the light bulb went on in my head as to the lack of authority that I had, there was no way for me in good conscience to continue doing that job for any length of time at all. And so by the week of April 15th, I submitted a written resignation. I did not disclose to my superiors the nature of my reason for resigning. I just simply left quickly and quietly.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, as far as you're concerned, there is no legal basis, or aren't people required to pay taxes, or are they, according to the law, required to pay taxes?
Well, that's a big question. My conclusion is that the way the tax law is written, it's perfectly constitutional. One of the reasons it's constitutional is because it's been written so cleverly to appear that just about anybody who has anything called income is liable to file and pay. That because they've written it that way in such careful terms, you talk to anybody and you get a different answer from the typical tax professional or researcher as to, some, the truth in some of these areas. My professional opinion is that the 16th Amendment, and this is even if the 16th Amendment was ratified, and there's credible information to show that it was not, but even if it was, if you go back and look at the congressional intent, what all those intelligent men, our elected leaders back in the turn of the century, were discussing among each other about the purpose for having an income tax and who would be taxed and all those things, it's very clear for anybody that takes the time, and the government knows this, that they never intended to tax you and me working at a job or a little enterprise to pay to provide our families with, the money that we need to support ourselves. They never intended to have the law. And the fact is, the 16th Amendment as it stands does not, if it was being applied correctly by the IRS, it does not apply to the multitude of American people.
For our listeners out there, we do carry that book, The Law That Never Was, going into the background of course, this effort to pass the 16th Amendment, pointing out that it really wasn't ratified by sufficient states. All of this thing was, of course, contrived, and they simply lied, saying it was ratified, but it wasn't ratified. And it's a fascinating book. Actually, it's two volumes, and it's important that you have the information. On the other hand, I am not suggesting that anybody out there doesn't pay their taxes. Otherwise, you're going to spend all your time hiding your money and doing this, that, and the other thing, where you should be helping us educate the American people. Now, is there a growing movement among people not to pay their taxes? How many people now are just dropping out of the system?
Yeah, the movement is growing, and the IRS and the Department of Justice and Congress and all of those people recognize it, and they're working overtime to try to rectify the situation, of course.
I hear that they're talking really about shifting over to a consumption tax. They haven't told the American people yet, but that's really where they're going. What are your thoughts on that?
They've been talking about a consumption tax for many years. In fact, what I said a minute ago about if a person reads the congressional record, what the congressmen and the senators were talking about a few years prior to actually having the 16th Amendment become law, they were talking about the same thing: consumption tax. How do we do that if we tax corporations? And they just pass it on to the working people, and that's what we're trying to rectify. So that's always been a problem, and it will be a problem if they switch from the income tax and go to something else that's representative of consumption. It won't solve the problem. It'll just be oppressive to regular Americans who are just trying to figure out how to make it through each week and have enough to survive and pay their bills.
Well, of course, the big thing is not to figure out how we're going to get the tax money. The big thing is to do away with most of the government departments, get back to the Constitution, and most of what the government is doing at the national level is not constitutional. And if we had people in Washington, D.C. who believe in the Constitution, then we would shut down the Department of Energy and the Department, the IRS, and we would certainly shut down the Department of Transportation. We would have a small military. You do realize the average individual out there doesn't realize that the federal government spends more or as much on our military as the next 20 nations together. I mean, Germany, great big Germany in the heart of Europe, spends about $25 billion a year on its military. We're spending $400 billion. We're going to spend $400 billion this coming year. I mean, why are we spending all this money to, it's for our defense. Are we defending America? No, we're establishing an empire. So what we really need to do, of course, is do away with most of what we're doing. And, of course, we need a defense for America, but we're not defending America. We don't even have an anti-ballistic missile system that would protect us from the missiles the Russians are supposed to have. But, of course, we're finding money by every means we can, or rationale for every reason we can, to continue funneling money into Russia. So there's something wrong with this whole picture.
I don't disagree with you about if the elected leaders, if they would follow the Constitution and if they would downsize government, I mean, that would be wonderful, wouldn't it? I wanted to add to that, however, that if the American people, if the regular citizens, we as regular citizens have gone asleep at the wheel for years. We've just delegated these elected people to just run our affairs for us, and they're doing a poor job of it. And now we are so entrenched with programs and overspending and laws that really are being applied in ways that they shouldn't be. It's time for the American people to wake up. That's why I appreciate people like you having shows like this. It's time for regular people to get more involved with what's happening in this nation, the governance of this nation. You know, we delegated the power to them, and they have taken it and done things with it that they weren't supposed to do. If we the people get more educated and knowledgeable about how things are supposed to be, we can demand that they have smaller government. But right now the problem is, Stan, as you know, too many regular Americans, they seem to like big government.
Isn't that a shame?
One of the things I experienced, this is just sort of a side thing, but it'll illustrate in a small way what we're talking about here. Everybody wants, you know, the other guy to give up his welfare, his socialistic program or whatever, but they don't want to give up their own. For instance, when I was a field officer calling on people, I called on people from all walks of life, poor people, wealthy people, city people, country people, and where I live up here, there's a lot of ranching and farming and things going on, and I would occasionally call on fairly well-to-do landowners who had orchards and whatnot, but they would also have obviously a tax problem, which is the reason for my visit with them. And in reviewing the problem and talking about the solution and going over their financial information, some of these farmers, they're just salt of the earth people, as you know. They're down to earth, friendly, even with an IRS agent. And sometimes we'd be talking philosophical things. Things that were going on, current events in the nation and whatever, and they'd be talking about, well, you know, I don't mind paying my taxes, but they're just, it's just too high, and guy can't retain his capital and reinvest it in his business and do all this. And so they'd be complaining about this. And then they'd make statements sometimes, something like this. They'd say, well, you know, those people in the cities that don't work, they won't work, and they're just too eager to line up every week, every 2 weeks, and get their handout check from the government. I wish the government would cut that out. Well, then I would remind them in a nice way that according to the information that they had shared with me because of their tax liability, that they were the recipients of some government benefits themselves, like low-interest loans and grants and subsidies, you know, for being paid not to plant, and on and on. And so they had government welfare at a higher level than the people they were complaining about. My point is, nobody in this country wants to give up, you know, anything, make any sacrifices at their level. They want everybody else to make the sacrifices. Until, my opinion, until we all basically have some truth serum about how bankrupt this nation is, and agree that we've all got to be responsible for ourselves and that only a very few small percentage of people truly need some kind of government benefit, not millions of people. Until we can get past that, I don't think things are going to change, do you?
I don't think so either. Well, let's go to Nathan, who's calling in. Hi, Nathan. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, yeah. Good evening, gentlemen. Your guest just touched on the basic point of my question, which is, you know, acknowledge everything you're saying, and, you know, I don't think the Supreme Court even ruled on the income tax at one time before the 16th Amendment passed and referred to it as, in their words, communistic. I think it's maybe more, our system is, our Federal Reserve system is probably more likely to be called fascistic. But
okay,
I think that my question is, any way you cut it, realistically, is there any real chance that we can change back to a more constitutional system? Or is this it? Do we have to deal with it? Because it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of hope.
Dan, I can't hear Nathan.
All right, well, Nathan is basically saying, is there any way we can get back to a constitutional system, get away from what we're talking about, or are we just going to have to put up with what we've got?
Well, I don't want to put up with it. Now, whether or not, is there any way we can? Certainly there is. Nathan obviously has a clue. He sounds like he was informed. He's knowledgeable of some of the problems. We need a whole bunch more Nathans and a whole bunch more Stan Montes and a whole bunch more John Turners, and there's other people out there. That's why I'm doing radio shows like this. If we can get a larger number of Americans out of their lethargy, paying attention, demanding that these elected representatives be responsible to us, then yes, we can. I believe, yes, we can have a constitutional government closer to what we should have. Will it happen overnight? No. Will there not be pain and sacrifices have to be made to go the other direction? Yes. But the bottom line is, Nathan, it must happen. Otherwise, this nation is not going to last.
Amen to that. I agree with that. Anything else, Nathan?
Well, I'm hopeful on a whole lot of issues. I'm hopeful that we could possibly stop this movement towards a global juggernaut. But, you know, the one thing I'm not maybe as hopeful on as you two gentlemen are, that we could really, at this point, get back to sort of what we could call the more constitutional system. I just don't think the people would go for it. I don't think that the voters would go for it. I don't think the elites would go for it. I don't think that really too many people would go for it. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, Nathan, all we can do is try. And it would be a shame just to give up, because that's what they want us to. And remember, as you've heard me say so many times before, it's a spirit's a battle. Our job is to do our best. But in the final analysis, the battle is the Lord's.
Okay.
Okay, God bless. Thanks. Good to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. And we invite your calls here. Love to hear from you. Get your input on how you feel about this issue. Paying income tax, nobody likes to pay it. But the trouble is, when the government has all this money, it's going to misuse it. And then, of course, it's going to buy the support. It's going to supply the support of the farmers. It's going to supply the support of the poor people. It's going to buy the support of the teachers. It's going to buy the support of the massive government bureaucracy. It's going to buy the support of the manufacturers by giving certain manufacturers favored tax status or a favored tariff status. And this is what they do, is they simply buy the support of each other groups with our own tax money. And then, of course, if they want to have a legislation passed, well, there's an effort now, of course, in California, in Southern California, to close down some medical facilities there, because, quite frankly, the city of Los Angeles doesn't have any money to keep Rancho Amigos or other of the medical facilities open. They're running a massive deficit. So the federal government, with our tax money, subsidizes this legal organization, this lawyers organization, that is now suing the city of Los Angeles, demand they keep open these medical facilities. They don't have the money to pay. They don't have the money to pay because the federal government is mandated they have to take care of all the illegal aliens, and that's costing them over $300 million a year. So they got to start shutting things down. So the local government is between one hand, where the federal government mandates they have to take care of people and doesn't compensate them, and then, of course, the federal government pays the lawyers to sue them to keep open the facilities, and Los Angeles County is facing bankruptcy because of government, total government problems. They create the problems, they compound the problems, and if the government didn't have the money, they wouldn't be able to hire these legal organizations to bring the lawsuits. They wouldn't be able to, of course, mandate all the hospital facilities take care of people who are in the United States illegally, and of course they even bring them in ambulances from Mexico, so we have to pay for their medical care. If we got back to the Constitution, there is no authorization in the Constitution for most of what the federal government is doing. So, John, as you talk to people across America, do you sense there's an awakening out there? Do you think people are beginning to understand that we got a real problem, and if we don't get involved, why nobody will?
I very definitely do sense that, Stan. I'd like to add that the problem that I perceive and many others with respect to the way that the IRS is misapplying the law with the income tax, the income tax problem is significant as it is because it impacts everybody. It's only part of the problem. We have, as you probably talk about in your show from week to week, so many similar type examples of government intrusion and overbearance in our lives in areas outside of income tax. It's just unbelievable. And yes, people in lots of areas seem to be upset, concerned, activating, getting together, talking about it. The internet is a huge tool for bringing people together and communicating and people learning. Income tax is a significant problem, but it certainly isn't the only problem we face.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I think it's so vitally important that you're doing what you're doing. And, of course, do you know Joe Bannister?
Yeah, Joe and I are on close terms.
Okay, fine. And, of course, there are people out there doing exactly what you're suggesting to do. And what we need to do, of course, is create this awareness. Now, right now, America, in my opinion, is on the verge of a catastrophic economic collapse. And, of course, I think we're moving into deflation. We do not have an industrial base. We've lost 2.6 million jobs in the last 26 months. These are jobs that are never coming back again. And we're going to lose a lot more jobs before this recession is over. And when we come out the other side, we're going to find a two-class society with the majority of the American people being impoverished and really not able to pay their income tax. And then, of course, we're going to start cutting back on all these wonderful programs that everybody's been clamoring for more money from the government, and they're just not going to be there. Freedom, though, you can never be free when you have your hand out taking money from the government. And, of course, liberty and limited government are synonymous. They are buying our freedom with our own money. So what would your advice be to our listeners?
I would salute what you said essentially a couple of times during this hour, which is, for most people, the idea, the notion of not filing and paying their taxes, it generally brings on more problems than they can handle, quite, you know, just being very matter-of-fact about it. And I don't ever tell people, don't file, don't pay, but I am only too glad at every little soapbox box I can get on to tell people, share with people from my insider standpoint, why the income tax is
being administered in a fraudulent way, why the government is not telling the people the truth, and let them get interested in it. Let them do like I did and roll up their sleeves and get the facts for themselves. They don't have to necessarily stop paying taxes to become an adversary that a congressman can't ignore. And you put several of us together in a room, and eventually they're gonna respond to us. They must respond to us. Right now, we're just not making a big enough impact. More people, more time, more knowledge. You better believe they're gonna respond to us. Mm-hmm. I wanted to for the students in your audience who are listening. I'm sure there's some people who are listening in a curious way, but there's probably some who are serious, who like to read and get into it. I'd like to leave a website for people in that category, if that's okay.
Go right ahead.
They should go to Constitutional Income. That's all one word, constitutionalincome.com. And the book that they should be interested in securing is called Constitutional Income, Do You Have Any? It's written by a man named Phil Hart, and the mailing address for somebody that doesn't have access to the Internet would be Alpine Press, 1324 North Liberty Lake Road, Postal Mailbox 145, Liberty Lake, Washington, 99019. The book's about $25, I think. I think that includes shipping, mailing and shipping.
Well, what's the book about?
It's Phil wrote it about, he did extensive research in the history of the 16th Amendment, the purpose of it, the congressional intent behind it, and he espouses that basically what I said earlier, that the 16th Amendment, even if it was ratified, it did not change the other taxing statutes in the original Constitution. In other words, it did not allow the IRS to tax directly your paycheck, which is what they're doing, and they're grossly breaking the law doing that.
All right, fine. Well, I appreciate so much your being with us, and we hope maybe we can get you back on some of the other programs. Please keep in touch, and God bless you for everything you're doing.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thanks. Good night. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program this evening. Two entirely different programs, but I think it's well worthwhile. Please pray for America. Understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political and ideological battlefield. Is there hope? Certainly there's hope. There's always hope if you believe in the Lord and you believe that we are doing what we should be doing. And I hope that you will be motivated by what you hear here to join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation under God can long endure. So please, of course, pray for America and pray for our leaders, for our boys overseas. And, of course, please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And if you want to get in touch with us, remember our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. Good night. May the Lord be with you.